Why?
Why?
If you
Why?
Have T-Mobile 5G home internet, you might be hearing this
Why?
A lot.
Why?
Every time your internet slows down during the busiest hours.
Why?
Why?
Because your network gives priority to cell phone users.
Why?
Good question. Why not switch to Cox Internet with 2x faster download speeds than T-Mobile 5G home internet during peak hours?
Okay.
Stop the whys and visit cox.com/5G home for details. T-Mobile prioritizes certain T-Mobile phone users over home internet users during times of congestion.
How powerful is Cox Internet? So powerful that one day, your daughter will be able to simulate a soccer match against some of the world's best players right from your backyard. Get gig speeds powered by fiber from Cox. It's internet built for tomorrow, today. Internet delivered through Cox's hybrid fiber coax network. Speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms and other restrictions apply.
Can ghosts be felt and not heard? If so, at what point must you stop telling yourself you're just imagining things and face the hard truth that you're not alone in your home? What do you do if every evening you find yourself confronted by something so evil you're worried it might consume you? And how do you stop it? Let's hear about the creaky Chicago carriage house with the death door today on Homespun Haints. Welcome, everybody, to Homespun Haints. I'm Becky.
And I'm Diana.
And we are joined today with Ren, who apparently has a very, very intense story he is going to share with us today. I'm very excited to hear it.
Awesome. A lot of pressure. That's for me.
I just want to say before we get started that Diana is currently, she's been evacuated from her home. She's holed up in Broken Arrow. Is that
Broken Arrow, Oklahoma? Yeah.
Trying to avoid tornadoes.
There's a tornado. There's three tornadoes that just passed us by. And then there's supposed to be baseball sized hail on the way.
And you had to evacuate there because of flooding, right?
Well, I chose to evacuate before I had to. they're talking about this one being, worse than the one in 86 and da 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 da. And I live right by the river, so I decided to go inland a little bit.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to put that out there in case you get cut off or you have to, duck under the bed. Or what was it you told me once? Overturn a sofa and wait till you smell detergent in the air or something like that.
I don't think the detergent, but yeah, the air turns yellow and it stops winding and raining. And then, yeah, you can turn a sofa upside down and use it like Nicolas Cage in the vampire movie to protect you from falling debris.
I immediately think of what kind of smell is going to get through anything that smells in my sofa. That probably nothing.
You'll be there for weeks. You'll never know if the air has changed.
Eating old Fritos out of the cushions.
Yeah, if I disappear, I apologize. It's not you. It's the weather. It was nothing you said. So
that's one I haven't heard from a date before.
I swear it's baseball-sized hail that's making me leave.
Well, anyway, since I want to make sure that Diana can hear your story before air raid sirens start going off, Ren, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you live, a little bit of your history, and the story that you're going to tell us, if it takes place somewhere other than where you live, give us a little bit of backstory about how you ended up there.
I was born and raised in Florida, just outside of Eatonville, where Zora Neale Hurston said a lot of her stories, deep south-ish Florida, as much as Florida can be. And orange groves and massive live oaks and just lots of wilderness and open spaces. And that kind of maybe speaks to a little bit of the story a little bit. So I grew up there and am now back living off the coast of Central Florida in New Smyrna. And I work in graphic design at a college. So that's where I am now and where I started. Where the story takes place is another thing that Becky and I share before we ever met each other. This all took place in Chicago, and it was the 90s. It was so long ago.
So far, it seems like there's a theme that the good ghost stories come out before the internet is a thing, really.
Yeah.
You can really look up where the hauntings are and avoid them.
Yeah. So this was a time where I moved to a big city for the first time. Very exciting. Glad to be leaving Florida. Swore I would never come back. So I went from all these open spaces and being near beaches and forests and was thrust into a city where that wasn't so much the case. But one thing that did save me is when I first moved there, I lived on the lake, like two blocks off of the lake. So I could go there and escape just, you know, the not oppression of the city, but just feeling really pent in. It's also why I liked snow so much, because everyone stayed in after the first snow would happen. And I would go out roaming the city and not see anybody else, you know, for an hour or two if I wanted. So at this time, I had been up there with roommates for about 6 or 8 months near the lake and had a falling out with roommates and just went to live on my own. And I had lived on my own in college before, but just in an apartment, you know, surrounded by other people. But I ended up finding a house. So I moved into this carriage house. That is the focal point of this story, is this house that I was in. It was two stories, but extremely small. One bedroom upstairs, a bathroom, kitchen, and one room downstairs. And it was built probably after the Great Fire. So it was 1880s, early 18 to mid 1880s. It was just a weird, weird place. Nothing was level. None of the doorways were straight. Like even walking in it, you could tell that, you know, things were just a little bit off. It was kind of like a fun house that ultimately wasn't so much fun. And washer and dryer were outside underneath an overhang in the dirt. When I first came into the house, there had been two guys and a girl living there with a dog, and they couldn't wait to get out of there. They couldn't wait to get out of that house. They said something that I don't know if the word existed then, but kind of snarky, which is like, oh, I hope you're going to enjoy this place. It's great. It was just weird. And there was a stairwell. It was two stories, so it went up to the bedroom. And there were all these packing peanuts underneath the stairwell. And I couldn't figure out why. I just didn't care. I was pretty young. But eventually I figured out why. The house had, the heat was barely functioning, which is an issue in Chicago because it gets really, really cold. But they had put the peanuts there to insulate from some drafts that were coming in underneath the stairwell. It was just all very quirky and bizarre. There was also something that I called the doorway to death. There was a sister building that had many apartments, but this building was just like in a dirt lot that people parked in, but there were no other buildings next to it. Yet there was a doorway on the second floor that if you opened it from the inside, it's just a drop down. So it must have been connected to something else at some time, but definitely wasn't at that time. And the door was not bolted. Like I could open the door and just look out. If you're a sleepwalker, probably a problem, which thankfully I wasn't. So it was just kind of an odd, odd little place to begin with.
Oh, but I moved
in and I was very excited on my own, away from my roommates, ready to work and enjoy my life, you know, in Chicago. But it was a great, great location. I worked in River North, which is the arts district. And I was transitioning from being a painter into a photographer. I was very excited about that. And so I'd walk over the bridge to River North and go over the river on Grand Avenue. And the two things that have always stuck out or the things I remember about those walks, I walked every day to work and every day back to work pretty much, were Bloomer's Chocolate, which was over in the Fulton District, two blocks away. So the heavy, heavy smell of chocolate all the time. And I love the smell of chocolate, but I mean, after a while, it was just so heavy. So I do remember that. And I always remember every day back and forth to work, I'd walk past the Salvation Army on Grand. There's this big sign. And you know, the Salvation Army, you just think of dinging bells and the money and everything. It's all this positive stuff. But every day I'd walk past and the big seal was there and it just said blood and fire. That's their motto or their war cry, as they call it, blood and fire. So every day I'm just like, it's just in my head, blood and fire, blood and fire. It's just so weird. It was just a weird, weird thing. And I do remember those things most of all. But I did enjoy the work I was doing. Again, it was in photography and it was just a good time. in that regard. And about 2 weeks in, into my new place, and I've got my furniture, and I hear a, there's like a knock on the door. People don't come up to, the building looks weird from the outside. It's super old, dilapidated. It's not something where people are, solicitors or anyone is going to come knocking on the door. So I hear this knock on the door, and it's like 9:30 at night, and this girl is there, a little scrawny, glasses and kind of greasy matted hair, not girl like child, but girl like young woman my age at the time. And I'm just like staring at her, and I'm just looking at her fingers. When I was in the Art Institute studying painting, there was a professor that just went on and on. I'm going to say the name properly, I hope. People would say Jean-Paul Dominguez Ingres, but it's Ankh. All his female figures had this, and I forget the name of it, but it was some type of distortion of the fingers where they were worm-like. And so the professor brought that up, you know, the same way Modigliani's women have longer necks. Like these were long, worm-like fingers. And like, so I'm watching her, and her fingers look just like that. And she's talking to me, and I'm not really focusing on what she says until she says this. I've been watching you for the past 2 weeks, so I figured I might as well come over and introduce myself. I was just like, what in the world are you doing?
Oh my.
So I start thinking about, okay, what has she seen? Have I been nude, dancing around? Or what does she mean she's been watching me? So she was very odd, and I got rid of her, not in a rude way, but just kind of forgot about her. So there were all these quirky little weird things about the area and the time period. And about two more weeks in, I started feeling a presence at night. Every night I would go and lie in bed, and I would feel this presence from above, and it would just surround the room. It just felt like it would spill out from the ceiling and come around the walls and just envelope all the room and come up under the floor, to the point where I felt like I cannot get out of the bed. Like, I cannot get out of the bed. Do not get out of the bed. Do not touch the floor. Basically, the bed is the only thing saving you from this thing, whatever it is. And it would come every night, and there'd be different degrees of it. Some nights it would be heavier, some nights it would be lighter. And there was a closet, as I started to become more like in tune with what, not what it was, but where it was coming from. Their closet had one of those drop ceiling type things. If you pushed up, I think you could go into an attic, but I was never going to push up, and I was never going to go into whatever that crawl space was, because that's where the presence was. And I would feel it like nonstop all the time. But I would feel like that, like a paralysis where I was awake, but I felt like I just couldn't move at times. Like I felt like at points it would seep up when it was powerful. It would seep up the bed and come and hold me and just hold me down and just like sit on me and hold me down. And things would happen. Objects would be moved. There was a door to the bedroom upstairs. You'd go up to the stairs right to the door and you're in the bedroom, and there was a lock on it. And I guarantee you, I never, ever, ever locked that door, because I never, ever wanted to be locked in the room at night with this presence. But it would be locked in the morning, or sometimes I'd come home and that door would be locked, and I'd have to, like, you know, it had the little hole, and you'd stick a paper clip in, you know, to get the door open. And I was so alone at that time period. I only think I had visitors every once in a while, but people could feel like they would walk into that place and be like, this place is just weird. You know, it's just, place is weird. You know, no one ever walked in and said, wow, this is great. You got a great little place here. You know, it's just always everyone, I feel, felt that. And I feel like those people that left must have felt it too. And I was mentioning it to someone here last night, and they're like, why didn't you just move? I mean, it was like the only place I could afford at the time. And I was in there for, I don't know how many months, at least 6 months, dreading going to bed at night, but still doing it. Like, I had to do it. And I didn't feel like sleeping downstairs was going to change it, because I think I tried that. I just felt like it would just, it just took over the house, and it made me feel like something bad had happened there. Because it's basically a servant's house back in the 1880s, a carriage house. That's what they were. And so something must have happened, I felt. And I never felt a presence like a person. Like, I never felt like, oh, this is a woman or a man. It just felt like this evilness. It didn't feel like, oh, a spirit longing for company, or it just felt very personal. It was just a scary thing. It was really scary, but I felt like I had to do it. And obviously I lived, like, I never felt like it's going to kill me. And then there was a time that it stopped. Months and months later, there was this incredible gas surge where just a lot of stuff in the neighborhood blew up. And I was at work and it came on. My boss at the time, who was my boss for many years, would listen to the weirdest things on the radio, but he was always had the radio on. Like during the Jeffrey Dahmer thing, he played that trial all day long, every day of the week. That's what I'm listening to at work. Like all of this stuff. I'm like, I can't stand it, but it's like, he's your boss. So, but he had the radio on. We heard the explosion from where we were. We're off of Franklin in Ohio. So it wasn't that far away. There was this big gas surge. So ovens were blowing, gas appliances were melting, just things were blowing up. And I was like, oh crap, my house where I live. He's like, we gotta go. Let's go check it out. And in the back of my mind, first thought is, okay, my stuff's gonna be ruined. Second thought was like, this is great. This house is gonna blow up. My worries are over. The house is gonna be blown up. So, but it wasn't. Like, out of all the places, it was absolutely not blown up, you know. But we're driving, and so we're rolling around. You could see fire and there's debris. And then we went to the place that I mentioned before while I was living in the basement, and we got as close as we could there. But the building across the street from that was about as old as the building I was in, much bigger. And it was a photographer who I knew. I hadn't worked with him before, but that building was completely blown apart and gone. And 3 people died there. And I just always remember seeing bricks burning. Like, I never thought bricks could burn, but there was just bricks everywhere, just on fire. You know, so I had to go home that night, but I just didn't ever feel that presence again in that space after that gas explosion. When it happened, I was like, that's my house. Whatever's in that space did this. You know, it's nonsensical as that is. Of course, it's like some substation mishap or something where gas just surges. But I was like, that thing has blown up my neighborhood. It's like some vortex of evil and has blown up my whole neighborhood. So, but it ended up like that seemed to be something that stopped it for however long I was there. Like, none of that stuff really happened that much again. It's just hard to put into words because I wasn't visually seeing anything. That door up there would lock and things would be moved. I wouldn't see them move, but they would be moved. And there was just this presence, which doesn't sound scary, except when you're in it, you feel trapped. Like, you just feel trapped and like you couldn't move, and almost a paralysis of fear kind of, and just feeling the presence on you, you know, every night. And again, it would vary, you know, it could be very light or it could be very heavy at times. It was visceral, definitely, but it was just not something seen or heard. It was something felt, which to me was scarier kind of, because I couldn't attach it to a person or something, like a person you feel like, oh, I could talk to this entity, or this was a person once, or is not just the embodiment of some horrific act or some series of acts that took place in the household.
I think that almost makes it scarier because it's even less identifiable.
Yeah, that's how it felt, I think.
Yeah. And I can identify with that some. I remember having an apartment in Oak Park, again, living on my own, excited to have this historic apartment. A lot of Chicago, as you know, was built in the 20s. And this was one of those structures. This was early 2000s. So it was about 80 years old at the time. And there was just something about that place. And I knew it when I rented it, but I was, again, like you, so excited to have my own place and I could afford it. And it was close to work and I had a parking spot. And it just seemed like it didn't matter that the minute I closed my eyes at night, I had these dreams of dead children watching me, and it got so real that I ended up just not staying there anymore. I had a place to go. I stayed with my boyfriend's parents, which was also weird, but I can identify with that. It's just this terror, you know, you're all by yourself, but at the same time, you're so excited to have this place anybody who's ever had to try and find real estate in Chicago, especially in a cool part of Chicago, knows that it's, you just kind of put up with it because you're there, you're in River North, right?
So yeah.
Still that house you described sounds, I was getting goosebumps just when you were describing it. I would love to see a photo of it if you can dig.
Yeah, I'll try to track it down. I haven't really wanted to, I think. And there's one object that I kept from that house that I still have. It's, what is it called? It's Red Wing Stoneware. They made it in Michigan. And it's this crock that I found out where the washer and dryer were. And that's the only thing I've kept from there. And I see that almost every day because out in my garden, I have some succulents in it. It's like this big 2-gallon crock that I look at. But I always felt like I never wanted to take anything of that space out of there. But that was the one thing I took. I don't know why I wanted it. Like I kind of wanted a memory of it or a memory that I wasn't there anymore. But I never felt like it followed me. So at first I felt like, oh, there's a reason this is happening. It's me, you know, I've triggered something with, startled this entity, or maybe everyone who ever lived there went through the same thing. And that's why, I mean, it was a dilapidated building. So that's why it was cheap and it was super cold. Like, I don't think it was legally heated, you know, it was just super cold.
I don't think there was anything legal about that building. I'm really surprised. Considering how strict the building codes are up there.
Yeah.
The packing peanut insulation.
Yeah.
And the death door.
And the death door.
Yeah, the door. Yeah, that thing was wild.
Did you ever have anybody else in the house who noticed any strange feelings?
I had some people come, but no one really wanted to stay and hang out. It was just like a weird vibe in the place. And I mean, it was run down and dilapidated, number one. But I mean, these were, you know, all artists who aren't very picky about such things anyway, but no one really wanted to stay. And no one ever said like, wow, this is a great place. People came in and we left. No one stayed. And it was not the place to bring home anyone with any amorous potential.
You had a bathroom in your kitchen, so.
Yeah, I did not want that to bring anyone into that type of space.
The tenants that were there before you, do you have any idea how long they were there before?
No, I don't. But they knew something. I don't know. It was just they knew like one, how cold it was, but also like they wanted to get out. Like in hindsight, I'm like, oh, I should have read something into what they said or how they said it or the looks they gave. I was not really going to enjoy the place like they said I would.
Well, you probably already signed the lease. There probably wasn't much you could do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I needed a place to stay, definitely. I think their address was Sangamon. It was just off of Grand, but
I'm going to look that up.
It was just kind of there by itself. There was other buildings around it, but it was like the other buildings didn't want to play. Like they were just kind of away from it, you know, like it was just a weird thing.
Oh, I've definitely got to look
it up. It can't possibly be there anymore. I know the Salvation Army's still there, but that building cannot possibly be there anymore. I felt like something happened there, like something really bad happened there. It felt inescapable, And even at the time, I felt like I would become attached to it somehow, or it would follow me, or it would attach to me. That's how I was starting to feel after a while, you know, until the gas surge. But I felt like there's that saying, it gets in your bones. Like I felt like this is going to get in my bones. This is going to follow me. And it felt like sometimes how people go crazy or they just can't deal with it anymore. And I'm like, this felt like if that got into me, I'd go out that doorway. Like that made me that doorway thing too. It was just like, okay, like it never spoke to me, but I felt like, okay, at some point it might tell me, it might move me or try to negotiate me or navigate me out that door. So like I could see that happening. Like I felt like it as it went on, like it's just going to get in my bones and it's going to become part of me and I'm going to become part of it. And I don't know that it needed an agent or someone to act in its proxy, but I felt like it would make me do something meaningful in a bad way to myself or something. It just felt like it would follow me. At a certain point, that energy would just become a part of me, if that makes any sense. Like it would follow me and then there would be no escape. Like it would not leave the house and inhabit me, but it would just become part of me and follow me.
Are you tired of websites that have been Frankenstein together?
Oh, my website is so slow and creaky.
Every time I use the search bar, it just returns Abby Normal over and over again.
Becky's sister company, The Concept Spot, holds the secret to life itself and can create new life from nothing. In fact, we've been giving life to highly functional websites for the last 25 years using premium parts we swear we didn't salvage from graveyards.
Ooh, check out that head. Image.
Instead of going,
my new website purrs.
Need a blog? The Concept Spot can do that. Want an online store? We can do that too.
We build our sites from the cellular level. No reused templates or discarded body parts here, so we can make your site do whatever you want and look however you want.
It's gorgeous! I can't even see the stitches.
We can also resurrect your dead website if rigor mortis has set in.
Oh, it's like a new man.
If you think Homespun Haints is frighteningly genius, you should see our websites. Let your favorite ghoulish gals, Becky and Diana, build you a monstrous website that will wreak havoc on the internet for years to come.
Visit theconceptspot.com for more information.
It's live! It's live!
Wow. Did you ever have this feeling in any of the other places you've ever lived?
No, the closest feeling I've had, like that was the ultimate, not in terror, but in fear, I think other than like human experiences with humans, you know, maybe trying to do something to me where I was afraid, but that was the ultimate in fear because it was uncontrollable and unescapable in my mind. It just felt unescapable. Like I had to stay there in that bed and it was not going to go away. And it didn't want me to move. It was all these things I felt like it didn't want me to do. Like I felt like it didn't want me to move. It didn't want me to leave. It wanted me there and was going to make that happen somehow. So that type of weird feeling, there was one end of the spectrum of fear and terror. And then the other end of the spectrum, which is that it's very weird. And I've thought a lot about this, how these two things are not bookending, but they're the same experience, but at different ends of the spectrum. Both things that the next thing I'm to describe was absolute paralysis, fear, terror, but euphoria at the same time. It's my closest experience to death that I've ever had. It was completely different. It was when I moved to San Diego, I would surf. So I was surfing a lot and the water's cold there. And I was at Oceanside, which is north of Carlsbad, north of San Diego, surfing like in March. So it's really cold. The water's really cold. And I was doing what you're not supposed to do, like surfing on my own, just out in the cold water. It's fairly cold there. I mean, not cold like Chicago, but just really cold water. No one else on the beach, no one else around. And hypothermia started to set in. And I've always maintained like a any way I could think to die, that would be the way to go. It was just a beautiful, weird experience because you're sitting there. And I recently did research and listened to a podcast where they go through, these are the five steps of hypothermia. Like, I think I got to number four. Or you know, your body and brain just disengage. They disconnect. In my mind, I'm thinking, I need to go in. You know, I'm getting afraid. I'm going to die. I need to go in. But my brain can't make my body work anymore because one by one your functions shut down, you know, and the first thing to shut down are your outer extremities. And so I'm like, I can't move my arms. I'm just sitting here on a surfboard. But then I'm also starting to feel this euphoria, like this incredible high or this great feeling. It just felt so good, and that, which made it even harder. Like, I've got to get moving. And I have no idea how long this went on, but I finally like snapped out of it, like made myself move and got to move and went to shore. But that was to me very similar to the other experience I had in that house in Chicago. And I think I have a photo of it. I have to find it of the house itself. But I mean, that experience, so they were so much alike, but so different in one, a euphoric experience that was still kind of terrifying because it was a near death experience. And then the other one felt like it was going to be near death and was just fear and terror, basically. That's the only other time I've had it. And it's weird that it was such a vastly different emotion attached to it in some regards. It's, again, kind of hard to describe, but I think the hypothermia one's easier maybe for people to understand. I don't know.
I think it's interesting. You mentioned that when you actually experienced hypothermia, it was in San Diego, and yet you lived in a poorly heated house in Chicago for 6 months.
Yeah. So it was both very cold, you know, and so yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, hypothermia is a very real thing in Chicago, as is frostbite.
Yeah, because I was there for one summer when I think 422 people died of heat. They didn't have air conditioning and no one wanted to open their windows. So a lot of old people just died from heat. And I've been summer there when 95. It's very cold and like tons of people have died, you know, so it's very, it happens. Like it happens a lot.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that. That was the summer of 95. It was brutally hot. And there was also another summer I remember where people kept dying because they would try and get out of their apartments and go out on the fire escape. Well, the fire escapes were rickety old wooden structures. Yeah. Who makes a wooden fire escape? But they would go out on these fire escapes to try and get away from the heat, and people would have these house parties and everybody would be out on these fire escapes, 40 or 50 people, and they would collapse. And there was one incident, I think it was 98 or 99, I'll have to look it up, when a porch party collapsed on top of another porch party underneath.
Oh my gosh.
Took out nearly 100 people. We often think of the nature kind of being dangerous down here in the deep south with the alligators and the bugs and the vicious spiders and stuff, but the weather up in Chicago is
Yeah, it can do it for sure, without a doubt.
You said the yard around it was all just dirt.
Yeah. This was before real estate wasn't going crazy there. But I have to imagine there's like a lot of that type of stuff in Chicago because there's so many old buildings. I mean, granted, the big fire came through, but there were so many old buildings at the time. Like even in River North, where the building I was working in used to be a manufacturing building. It was just lofts for photographers and upholsterers and stuff like that. All of that's gone, like all of its residents now, you know, in condos and things like that.
Well, it became trendy, so the artists had to leave.
Yeah, yeah. But I've thought, like, am I sensitive to this? And is this something I'm going to tune into in other spaces? But I've never had it anywhere else. Like, but when people tell me things, I believe, you know, like when someone says something, I'm like, well, you know, I've experienced something, so I can't judge your experience of what you had. I believe it can happen, you know, it's possible. I felt something and it definitely, it was a real presence. Like it's hard, you know, I didn't see it, but I know it was real. It was there and I felt it. Like I definitely felt it.
Did you ever run into Snake Finger Girl again?
She came to me a while later and it's the weirdest thing because I'm living in that building and I'm clearly don't have a lot of money and she's like, oh, we should go shopping up at Treasure Island, which was this, it can't exist anymore, but it's, you know, it's really upscale, you know, like for yuppies and stuff. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like one, it's far away. Two, it's a very expensive grocery store. And why do you think I would shop there or go with you there? I mean, it was just really weird. Like her whole scene was just weird. Like she seemed really awkward and she had made a bold move to come and talk to me. I mean, she was certainly nice, but it was just kind of creepy. The whole watching me type thing was just creepy. So I don't know.
Yeah,
definitely. Wow. Okay. And then the other thing that you said that kind of, I heard you say twice mention that maybe you felt like you had drawn out this entity, that something you had done had caused it to.
There was one thing that did happen and it happened and I don't know the timeline of it. And it's only in hindsight, if something had happened, like there was one night, someone from the sister building was moving out or something like that. I don't know. But the next morning I found a box, not a paper box, but like a moving box kind of thing. There was money in it. Like there was money, like $600-$700 cash in this box with a bunch of belongings and stuff like that.
Oh shit.
And I took that cash and the belongings and I didn't really try to find out who had moved out. I mean, again, this is not internet heavy time period. So I'd have to like really work. I guess I wouldn't, I don't know, but I was scared of the people in the other building anyway, because people had been stealing my mail and taking my credit card numbers and buying stuff around town. And I had filed a complaint. And so police went to talk to those people. I was like, I'm not going over the building because those people hate me because I tried to get them arrested. Like people that still live there. But the person that moved out, I mean, I probably could have tracked them down. And it's one of the things where I knew I did something wrong. I kept that money and I used it. Like I kept that money. I knew it was wrong. I justified it by like, oh, I won't be able to track them down, or I was meant to have this because I found it type thing. I try not to do the wrong thing, like in extremes, you know, in extremes where people are like, oh, just do that, just do that. I'm like, no, that's wrong. I'm not going to do that. Even if it's a minor thing that most people would do, but this was a major thing and I did it. Like I kept the money and didn't try to find the person at all. So I felt like in hindsight, I started realizing that when I was in San Diego, because then I was away from it all and I was processing and I was just like, what? If it was something that triggered it, was it that? And that was the only thing I could think of, because it was a lot of cash that was meaningful, I'm sure, to that person, just like it was meaningful to me. It would be meaningful to anyone living in those buildings because they were really poor, you know, buildings. So that was the thing. I thought that could be that. They were really into, because it was in the stuff, they were really into some guru or something like that. So it was just bizarre, like to have all this cash with all this guru stuff, which usually like they're like not having cash or anything like that. So that was the thing that I felt guilty about and could have triggered it. But I didn't feel guilty at the time. I felt totally fine about having the money. I felt like I couldn't find the person anyway, and I felt justified in having it, and that it was like God or Jah or someone saying, okay, you need money, here's money. That was the thing I felt like would have triggered it, if anything.
Unless, and you found that in the space?
In the right in the outside on the dirt lot, just a box was there with this stuff in it. Like I walked out in the morning, there's this box with this stuff and money in it. I was like, I'm taking it. You know, and just went inside.
I think that's fascinating that this box was just there. I mean, it doesn't seem like something that somebody would accidentally leave behind. It almost deliberate.
Unless they were running for their life. And like, I don't know if some guru follower, I don't know what would have happened to make them run for their life, you know, type thing. So,
but even still, they would have stuffed.
Maybe someone will hear this and they'll be like, hey, that was my money. You know, who knows, but
I don't know. I don't think
you back to them somehow if they do.
Podcast as opportunity for atonement.
Yeah.
Never be haunted again.
Yeah.
I don't think you should feel guilty about that. I mean, that was just from my experience, that was definitely part of the culture there is, you know, if something was on the side of the road, it was trash.
Yeah.
And I mean, I got a whole computer like that once.
Yeah.
Feel guilty. Someone left their computer. Okay, I'll take it. Yeah,
I still feel bad about it because I feel like that person needed the money probably just as much as I did, if not more. Yeah. But sure.
Well, I'm surprised that, you know, if somebody did leave it accidentally, they would have come back.
Yeah.
Knocked on the door. Hey, weird. Did you see a box?
Yeah.
Something.
It was just weird. In movies, you have to show a ghost. Like in a book, you don't have to, but in a movie, you have to give it a form for people to see. You cannot communicate it with an energy or a presence. I mean, maybe you can if it's physically moving objects or doing things like that. It's just doesn't register as super scary if you can't see something, even if it's a green fog or a body or something that you feel could do physical harm to you. It felt like it would be a sound wave, except it wasn't pulsing. Like it was just an energy that could be felt, but it was definitely not like a pulse. I don't know. It's really hard to describe. So I think it doesn't register for people unless you felt it. It can't be seen. Does that make sense? Or heard? You know, we're used to ghosts being a presence that's heard or seen or moving, or blood's coming out of the walls, or, you know, it's working on some terms that we can communicate where maybe that's not always going to be in a way that we can communicate other than a presence or an energy, if that makes sense. It does.
Oh, it does. Absolutely. And that's actually part of my inspiration for doing this podcast in general. It's just because I feel like the real stories that people can share are so different from the fiction, the movies and stuff, for no other reason than there are things that you just can't describe in a cinema context.
Right.
I am curious again about that dirt lot. Was there any grass or trees or any shrubbery that
I don't know. I hope I can find a negative or photograph by the time that this broadcast. But I guess it won't matter because it's a podcast. You won't be able to.
Well, if you can find it, we do have a website. We have a page associated with every episode.
I'll try to find it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We can put the photo on there and, you know, any other supplemental material.
I'll try to find it.
So the reason I keep getting back to this dirt lot is the lot where John Wayne Gacy's house was.
I really hope it wasn't that.
No, but no, it was.
Hate clowns.
It was a little bit further west, but
yeah, sure.
So after they discovered what happened at his house, the police and investigators tore the house to shreds, looking for all the evidence and trying to find all the bodies. The legend states that the lot that the house sat on became barren. Nothing would grow on it for nearly 10 years until, I guess, a developer came in and built a house on it. But for 10 years, it was like, again, I wasn't there, so I can only go by the stories, but the legend is that it just was dirt. Nothing would grow on it. The evil, the horror that had happened there just kept any growth, any vegetation from cropping up. And then right where the property line ended and the neighbor's property began, grass would grow, no problem. It was like a clean line around the edges of the lot.
Who wants that property?
Well, no, yeah, nobody would want it. But you'd think even just weeds or grass something
would grow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone would buy the property. People were buying his paintings. So when he was, who would want that? I don't know, but people did.
Is there anything else that you want to share related to this incident? Or
no, like I haven't really thought about it in a long time. So I'm glad that in some ways it happened, but at the time I definitely, like a lot of things that have happened to me at the time that seem really bad, I never want to go through again, but I'm glad they happened because I learned something from them. Or like now I just have a belief that there are things that happen, you know, paranormal things. I'm not so dismissive of them. It makes me feel better. Like I just can, like to know that I'm not in that place anymore. I don't know. Like it was really bad. Like it was just so.
I'm glad it's whatever you're experiencing stopped.
Yeah. It ended. And with the hypothermia incident, instantly, you know, associate the two as similar. And I felt like that was a good break too, you know, to understand these two similar things, completely similar, but one more joyous. And one definitely not so joyous. I don't know if any of that's very interesting. It's very hard to communicate like the just fear and how scary it was when it was happening. So,
oh no, I think it's a great story.
It is.
I loved it. Yeah. And you told it very well. Very evocative, especially describing that house. I can't wait to see a photo of it.
Yeah, I know there is one. I know it. I'll have to find it. I know. I hope I didn't destroy it. There's one other This is completely off topic, but there's another picture that it's completely off topic. I'm not even going to go into
it. No, go on. You have to now. You got started.
We're amazed that I tell this story, but it's just so funny to me. And I totally regret destroying a picture. If I destroy the one of the house, it'll be the same type of regret. So when I was a child, I was really tall for my age. I was like the second tallest kid in elementary school. So I looked much older than I actually was. And so one day, you know, I'm taking my bath. I don't know how old I am, but I look 8 or 9. I don't know, but I was younger. Whatever. So I'm taking a bath and I accidentally crap during my bath. You know, so I poop in the bathtub. And so my mom comes in and she's like, "You're cleaning that up. You're cleaning that up." And I just remember, and I've been in my mom's house a lot where I grew up. She still is living, you know, before now. You know, it's a powder blue bathtub, you know, from that time period. It's like everything's powder blue. Like I remember the colors, like the photograph was so good because it was so dated. And so I'm in there and she's like, "You're cleaning this up. You've got to clean this up." So she went and got like a pink plastic Tupperware bowl. And then she hands it to me. And so I'm picking up this piece of crap to put it in a bowl. And I'm standing up. So I'm like at full height, nude, with a pink Tupperware bowl and a turd in my hand. And there's a flash. Like she took a picture of it.
Oh, Mom. And if you're just a little younger, that would be on Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank God it only made it to a book, like when people would come to the house to look through a book, you know, a family photo. It's like, naked holding a turd. You know? But I destroyed that photo eventually.
Oh, no.
I can't deal with this anymore. It would be out there now. Like, I'd be into it now. I'd love to have that photo. But at the time, I was like, yeah, gotta go. I don't care if I get in trouble.
Oh, no.
That is entirely too old to be pooping in the tub. So, no offense to anyone who's doing that. It wasn't my thing.
Oh, that was a fantastic outro. Thank you. All right. So we have both of these experiences. What they have in common is you're glad you had them because now you know how to, you know, appreciate not being in that situation.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll be in the bathtub one again someday. Not for a while, hopefully. So.
Well, Ren, thank you so much. That was awesome. Really, really appreciate you coming on here. And I know that was like you said, it's been a while, and you mentioned it would be intense to remember it.
It is actually.
So, so
I feel fine. Really appreciate it. Okay, always helps lighten the.
Absolutely, we'll make sure we include that if that's okay with you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, wonderful. I don't care.
Okay.
It'll help some lad out there feel not so bad.
This is for you.
Yeah. Insert name of person here.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us today. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Homespun Haints podcast on your favorite provider. And check us out on Facebook at Homespun Haints or on Instagram at Homespun Haints. And be sure to tag your spooky photos with Homespun Haints so we'll be sure to find it.
Thank you for coming to tell that story. It was awesome. And until next time, have a spooky day.
Whether you want a laid-back trail to hit with friends or you're planning something more adventurous, All Trails Plus is your guide to making the most of your time outdoors. Get outside today with 3 free months of All Trails Plus with code PODCAST23 at alltrails.com/podcast.
Wait, are you gaming? On a Chromebook?
Yep. It's got a high-res 120Hz display, plus this killer RGB keyboard, and I can access thousands of games anytime, anywhere.
Stop playing.
What?
Get out of here.
Huh?
Yeah, I want you to stop playing and get out of here so I can game on that Chromebook.
Got it.
Discover the ultimate cloud gaming machine, a new kind of Chromebook.